Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RCVS specialist in veterinary anesthesia and analgesia, Miguel Martinez. Thank you, Miguel. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma, and good afternoon. Thank you for attending this webinar. And today I would like to talk to you about how to recognize and manage patients with circulatory shock, with a little bit of a focus on hemorrhagic shock, but I think we will talk a little bit about everything. The title of this lecture is called Shock Tactics. Right, so what is it that we are going to do in a situation like this? As you can see in the photographs, we have a very poorly dog, very collapsed, with severe hemorrhage, and obviously things need to be done fairly quickly. So we are going to go through the whole process and explain how to proceed in cases like this. What is the most important thing? The most important thing is to understand that shock is an emergency, which means that we have to actually go to the point. We cannot waste any time. And the first thing is to actually detect the most basic clinical signs, which are called cardinal signs. Once we have done this, then we need to have a plan of action and be as quick as possible to implement it. And the other thing that I'd like to emphasize is that we have to be aggressive in the treatment we are going to apply. In my experience, very often what I have observed is that people are scared of taking the necessary measures to correct the changes that we can appreciate in shock. And by not being aggressive enough, we under resuscitate and we do not achieve the results that we would ideally expect. So what is it that we need to know? We will need to know a fair bit about the pathophysiology of shock. Then we need to go through what are the cardinal signs of circulatory shock, so the main clinical signs. It's also important to be able to interpret some basic clinical data like blood results and the likes. Also, we need to perform some basic procedures, but do them correctly and very efficiently. It is followed then by applying simple protocols with, and very importantly, with some endpoints. So we will apply some treatments and measures, but we have to they have to be targeted to some endpoints where we know that we have achieved the results we want. And finally, we will go through how to use our monitoring equipment, and this is very necessary to actually see what is the effect of our treatment in the patient. So what is it that we need to do? As I said before, we need to perform a basic clinical exam, which needs to be quick and systematic. I'd say that in a case of shock, a very severe shock, this should not take more than 1 or 2 minutes. After that, we will need to develop a plan of action, and this needs to be communicated to the people working with us. We follow this with the application of an appropriate treatment. And like I mentioned before, we need to do some monitoring, but more important than just the talking about monitoring itself is this concept of serial monitoring. And this means that we don't do like only a one spot check and then that's it, and then we don't come back to it. Shock is a very severe derangement, and things change really quite dramatically in a very short period of time, which means that we will have to monitor our patients very closely and then assess the trends in the different cardiovascular and other variables that we are measuring. What do we need to have in order to deal with a case of circulatory shock? First of all, it is very important to have a well-trained team of veterinary professionals. So it's not only the vet, but also the nurses and other lay staff that need to be aware of what is involved in the treatment and detection of shock and how to implement all the plans that we kind of devised. A well-organized emergency room is also very important. It is fundamental, really, that all the equipment that we are going to need and all the drugs and other aids are going to be handy. And for that, there is some previous work to be done, which is for nurses or anybody in the team to actually have everything prepared and labeled and organized in an area where everybody knows where the equipment and the drugs are and how to get them quickly. We do definitely need some monitoring equipment, and then we will discuss in a few minutes what is the basic equipment, the most basic equipment we need, and then what is more advanced, and also a minimum stock of fluids and drugs that we will also discuss in later slides. With regards to the equipment, the three very basic things that we will need will be intravenous access through an IV catheter, usually peripheral, but it could be also a central catheter. We need oxygen supply, very important in any critical patient. Oxygen very rarely has any harmful effects. However, it could be life-saving in very many situations. Therefore, it has to be available to us. And then, like we said before, monitoring equipment, ideally in the form of a multi-parameter monitor, but it could also be different pieces of equipment that we are going to use and make the most out of. What drugs do we need? Three principal groups of drugs. One of them is fluids. There is a variety of them, and we will discuss them all separately. We will also need vasopressors, so drugs that increase blood pressure, which is one of the main variables that we're going to be measuring and targeting. And also, we will possibly, in some cases, need inotropes, so drugs that increase the contractility of the heart. So, what is shock? So, as defined by Dr. Karen Matthews, shock is a syndrome precipitated by a systemic derangement of perfusion, and it leads to a widespread cerebral hypoxia and vital organ dysfunction. So, what happens in a patient that suffers shock is that the circulation is insufficient, blood flow is incorrect, it's inadequate, and oxygen delivery and glucose delivery to the different tissues and fundamentally to the main organs is inadequate. So that leads to cellular hypoxia and from there organ dysfunction. In the end, there is a cascade of events where one organ fails and then it's followed by another until you go into a severe shock and irreversible states of shock. What are the types of shock that we are going to find? So the one that we are going to kind of focus a little bit more today is hypovolemic shock, an example of which one would be a severe hemorrhage, which could be intraoperative or outside theater. Another type of shock would be distributive, and the best example of that is a case of sepsis, where the circulating volume is initially probably adequate, but it's the distribution of this circulating volume what makes the organs fail. Another case is cardiogenic shock. Example of that would be systolic failure, like in an end-stage dilated cardiomyopathy or even in an end-stage case of mitral endocarditis, endocarditis. And finally, there is another type is obstructive shock, and the best example probably would be cardiac tamponade in pericardial effusion. So, what are the clinical signs that we are going to be assessing? So, we have cardiovascular signs, we have respiratory signs, we have also signs that affect the central nervous system, and also we need to keep an eye on the temperature. The evaluation of these clinical signs will lead to the diagnosis of shock, or the confirmation of diagnosis of shock. With regards to the cardiovascular signs, the first one we will focus on will be heart rate. In a case of shock, we can find three different types of abnormalities or groups of abnormalities. One of them would be tachycardia, so a fast heart rate, which is the usual, the most common compensatory response of heart and the circulatory system under stress. So there is an increase in the rate of the heart in order to improve the cardiac output. However, there are other cases, particularly cats in hypovolemic and other types of shock, and also in patients suffering from Addison's disease, where we can find bradycardia. So it's not uncommon that we find a very collapsed cat with a heart rate of 110 or 120 that in the first place we could consider adequate, but in this case I would call this a relative bradycardia for a patient that under stress should have a faster heart rate. And a third case of heart rate abnormality would be arrhythmias, which could be either bradyarrhythmias or tachyarrhythmias, and the majority of them are tachyarrhythmias, and it would be cases of ventricular tachycardia or accelerated ventricular rhythm, which are typically seen in cases of shock. What about the pulse quality and rhythm? Of course, it's very, very important as a basic assessment, part of our basic clinical exam, to assess the quality of pulses. And we will assess the femoral pulse as a central pulse, but also I think I would like to stress how important it is to assess the presence and the quality of a peripheral pulse. That could be a metatarsal or metacarpal pulse in any patient. And why is this important? Well, in my opinion, and I think I share this with many colleagues, whenever we have a peripheral pulse, it's an indication that perfusion to the peripheral and less important organs might be low, but it's not completely compromised. However, if there is no peripheral pulse, it's an indication that there is a severe lack of perfusion. And however, if we assess the femoral pulse, there are many patients that have a very severe decrease in cardiac output and perfusion and still will have a femoral pulse present, and only in the previous stages to cardiac arrest the femoral pulse will disappear. So the fact that we detect or not a peripheral pulse, it's will be an early indication that action has to be taken. Finally, we will need to assess, as part of our basic clinical exam, the color of the mucous membranes and the capillary refill time. My main concerns will be if we find a pale mucous membranes or hyperemic mucous membranes, like in cases of sepsis. What about the respiratory system? As part of our assessment of the cardinal signs, we will observe the respiratory rate and pattern. Patients in shock very often will show tachypnea, although in some cases this might be completely the opposite, so bradypnea. With regards to the pattern, we will observe whether there is any restriction to breathing or any increased effort, whether this is inspiratory or expiratory. We also will perform an auscultation of both sides of the chest in several areas to detect any abnormal lung sounds or the lack of lung sounds. And finally, and I find this particularly relevant, we will, in every patient, we will try to obtain an SpO2 and saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen by means of a pulse oximeter. This is a very inexpensive test and very simple to perform in almost every patient awake or asleep, and it's a very important indication of the level of oxygenation of blood, and also it is an interesting indication of the quality of peripheral pulse. So very often a low SpO2 will be an indication of poor peripheral perfusion rather than lack of oxygen available. As you can see in the picture, we can take an SpO2 reading from almost any patient of any size. What are the clinical signs we will be looking at in patients with suspected shock? Well, with regards to the central nervous system, it is very important to assess the level of mentation. So patients in shock very often are very subdued, obtunded, or even comatose. And in many cases, they're non-ambulatory because they're collapsed. Another thing that we have to pay attention to will be the temperature of the patient. So obtaining a rectal temperature should be part of our routine assessment of any patient, and particularly those suspected to suffer from shock. And hypothermia is a very typical finding. Again, typical picture of a cat with slightly subnormal temperature and a slightly subnormal heart rate will be a great indication of low cardiac output and earlier advanced stages of shock. Another important thing, if we were able to measure it, is to see if there is a difference in the temperature difference between the periphery and the core of the body. And finally, in patients in shock, and as an anaesthetist, I have to say that it's important to assess whether the patient is in pain, and if so, treat that immediately, as this will contribute to correct many of the responses elicited by the stress situation caused by pain. This is a picture of a patient in our intensive care unit that had been run over and suffered multiple injuries, including myocardial injury and bilateral pneumothorax and lung contusions. As you can see, oxygen is provided, and then monitoring of several different parameters was in place. What about analysis of blood sample? What is a basic blood profile for patients suspected to suffer from circulatory shock? So I'd like to know what is the PCB or the concentration of hemoglobin. This is an important indication of oxygen carrying capacity. Besides, I would like to know the concentration of glucose in plasma. And we will get this easily from a glucometer. And hypoglycemia would be a case that would potentially cause a clinical sign similar to patient being in shock, and it's easily corrected. Also, we will measure the concentration of total proteins to, amongst other things, assess the oncotic pressure and see whether we need to adjust the oncotic pressure of the patient. Also, urea and creatinine as indicators of the kidney function. It's also important to check the electrolytes and acid-base balance by means of venous or arterial blood gas. Abnormalities of electrolytes are easily corrected by means of fluid therapy, and the acid-base balance will indicate whether there is any abnormality, most commonly hyperlactatemia, in cases of hypoperfusion and anaerobic metabolism. And finally, once we have obtained a small blood sample, we could do a blood smear and do a coagulation test if indicated. There is a specific case in the management of shock in veterinary patients, which is diagnosis and management of shock in dogs under anesthesia. It's important to remember that when a patient is anesthetized, many of the compensatory mechanisms of the body physiologically are, well, that are present physiologically, they are obtunded or have disappeared, if you like. Interesting case, for instance, is when we compare isoflurane and sevoflurane with regards to the maintenance of cardiovascular stability in situations of severe hemorrhage and shock. And then studies have shown that isoflurane will maintain a good cardiovascular profile, like good blood pressure, little or no changes in heart rate, for a long period of time. And farther than sevoflurane does. This could be thought to be a good quality of this anesthetic agent and make it safer than others. However, although this is true to some extent, what the other interpretation of this characteristic of isoflurane is that by the time we could actually pick up any changes in the cardiovascular variables of these patients, so say heart rate and blood pressure, the blood loss that has occurred is so much more severe than in the case of using sevoflurane or any other agents. This means that the changes and the damage to the circulation and organs will be potentially greater. So in the end, what this suggests is that when we have an anaesthetized patient, we will have to monitor directly the amount of blood loss during the procedure and keep a very good communication with the theater team and more importantly with the surgeon. So any incipient blood loss is detected and communicated, and we start looking at changes and accounting for that blood loss from the early stages of the case rather than a little bit later. So what would be the immediate interventions that we would expect to do in a case of shock? The first thing I would do is to provide or supplement the patient with some oxygen. This can be easily done via a face mask or a nasal prongs or a nasal catheter. In case of an anaesthetized patient, normally we will have these patients already on a high percentage of inspired oxygen in the area of 90 to 100%. The next thing to do would be to gain intravenous access, and generally it will be necessary only to gain peripheral access. That would be either a cephalic vein or a saphenous vein or something like that. However, in some cases it could be indicated acceptable, if you like, or preferable to have a central line, which could be either a saphenous catheter, a long stay catheter, or it could be in the jugular vein. After that, we will try and take a quick clinical history. And this, if we happen to have help around us, this can be done by one member of the team while the rest of the team is working already on the patient by providing oxygen, gaining IV access, and doing all the other necessary tests and procedures that are required in an emergency case. And as this clinical history is obtained, then what we will do is from the very beginning set up some monitoring for the patient. Let's say, for instance, if we had a multi-parameter monitor, we could be measuring blood pressure, connecting an ECG to detect any arrhythmias or rhythm disturbances, and also the very important SpO2 reading to check for the oxygenation of blood. And another thing that is very important to do is to start a record of all these findings. It is fundamental to have a baseline TPR, temperature, pulse and respiratory rate, and if that can be enhanced with an SpO2 reading and blood pressure, that would be fantastic. From there, once we gain IV access, we will take some blood samples, and then we'll run at least a basic profile, and if available, maybe a more extended one. In cases of emergencies and shock, it is always a valuable thing to do a faster abdominal scan, which will check for hemorrhage of free fluid in the abdomen in four different quadrants, and also check for very quickly like the urinary system, and if required, it can be extended to a thoracic scan also. And finally, once we have done all these things, then we will establish a plan of action and then communicate this plan to all the members of the team so everybody knows what's their role, what needs to be done, and what we are to expect from the evolution of this case. Right. I show you here a picture of an abdominal ultrasound, what we call a fast scan, that was done performing in a large Great Dane in order to check the abdomen for any effusions. And in this case, we detected that there was a hemoabdomen. So in a case of hemorrhagic shock, one of the priorities will be to control the hemorrhage, of course. So we will find that there are different scenarios that I will try to explain one by one. So the first thing we need to do is just rule out if there is any type of coagulation disorder or coagulopathy. For that, we will run the usual tests and take a blood sample to do a blood smear and then check for the number of platelets and do a platelet count. Also, in the history, we will ask about the possibility of the ingestion of any anticoagulants or any history of coagulopathy in this patient or treatments with different drugs. Once this has been ruled out, or even if it hasn't, then we will have two different scenarios. One scenario will be that there is a hemorrhage with a compressible source of bleeding, and the second scenario will be that there is hemorrhage with a non-compressible source of hemorrhage of bleeding. Aside from that, I think it's important to mention what is the total blood volume in the two main different species that we deal with. In the dog, the estimated blood volume is about 90 milliliters per kilo of body weight, while in the cat, this circulating volume is less and is around 66 milliliters per kilo of body weight. And this is important at the time of accounting for blood losses to see what percentage of the total blood volume the patient has lost. So, how are we going to do? Or achieve the resuscitation of these patients. The most important thing is that we will have to do a volume replacement, and then we need to target some endpoints of resuscitation that we will discuss in the next few slides. However, there is some exceptions to this case, and those are cases of cardiogenic or obstructive shock, where there is actually not a lack of circulating volume. And if anything, sometimes there will be a volume overload. So resuscitation with high rates of fluids is totally contraindicated. And if anything, fluid restriction might apply. So what are the endpoints of resuscitations in cases of hemorrhagic shock? And probably say in cases of septic shock too. The first thing will be the improved mentation. Like we said before, when the circulation is very poor, blood flow to the brain decreases, and that leads to states of decreased mentation, and we find patients obtunded or even comatose. So if our resuscitation is effective, we will find that this level of mentation will improve over time. Another thing we're after is a normalization of heart rate, which could be more normally a decreasing heart rate from tachycardia to a normal range of heart rate for the species. Or in other cases, it might be an increase in heart rate, like in cases of Addison's or cats with this less usual form of shock where there is bradycardia or abnormally low heart rates. We will be also looking at a normalization of respiratory rate, so a decrease in the respiratory rate and an improvement in the respiratory pattern. And also, very importantly, a return of quality of any peripheral pulse. So if metatarsal or metacarpal pulses had disappeared and they returned, that is a sign that our circulation and our circulating volume is more adequate. And if it was weak, and then now we have a stronger pulse, that is also a good sign that there is a better distribution of the circulating volume. If we have more technology available, the next thing I'd like to check would be blood pressure, and that can be done either with an oscillometric blood pressure or with a Doppler blood pressure system, or in more advanced cases, if we have an arterial line, we can measure invasive blood pressure with a transducer. So what values are we targeting in this case? the endpoint of resuscitation in cases of shock would be to achieve a systolic arterial pressure of around 120 millimeters of mercury, or a mean blood pressure of around 80 millimeters of mercury. With regards to markers of perfusion, we would be looking at the endpoints of resuscitation of normalization of lactate below 2 millimoles per liter, or normalization of base excess, or in this case, normalization of base deficit, where previously the base deficit would be less than minus 4, and we would expect it to be closer to zero, really. Another thing that we can measure is urine output, and in a normal situation, we need urine output of around at least 1 mL per kilo per hour if we want to guarantee that the renal function is preserved. At this point, I'd like to say that it is very well known through research in humans and animals that it is not impossible, and actually it's fairly common, to have patients with normal heart rate, respiratory rate, peripheral pulses, and even normal blood pressures, where they will still be under-resuscitated, and then their organs do not have still a normal and adequate perfusion. That can be more easily detected through the measurement of lactate and base excess, and therefore, in these cases, I would always encourage you to take a blood sample and, where possible, run an arterial or venous blood gas or a lactate to check these values and follow the trend to assess the quality of your resuscitation. There is an exception to these guidelines for resuscitation, which will be the case of an uncontrolled hemorrhage. So if a patient is bleeding and you manage to control the source of hemorrhage, then you can do a resuscitation in full to maximize the cardiovascular parameters. However, if there is an uncontrolled hemorrhage, it is not recommended to do a full resuscitation, because more often than not, that would lead to an increased hemorrhage and also hemodilution, particularly if we do our resuscitation without blood products. So what it is recommended in these cases is to localize the source of hemorrhage whenever possible, and to rule out coagulopathy. And if there is some degree of coagulopathy, then treat that as required. In the meantime, until we find the source of this hemorrhage, we will do a resuscitation to suboptimal endpoints. And which are these endpoints? One of them will be a qualitative endpoint, which is improvementation. Another one will be a reduction in heart rate and improvement in pulse quality. And finally, we will resuscitate to a systolic arterial pressure of 90 instead of 120, and a mean blood pressure of 60 instead of 80. These are lower pressures that still often manage to guarantee a relatively adequate perfusion of the main organs, while at the same time not fueling, if you like, the hemorrhage of the patient. In the end, the most important thing will be to control the source of breathing. And if this cannot be achieved, our uncontrolled hemorrhage and our resuscitation will be ineffective in the long term. The other exception to the maximal or in full resuscitation will be the case of cardiogenic shock. These cases often need no fluid resuscitation at all, because if anything, as I mentioned before, they will be fluid overloaded through the stimulation of the RAS cascade. And also, in these cases, the objective will be to improve myocardial performance and reduce pulmonary edema or pulmonary congestion. So for that, what we are trying to do is cause some degree of vasodilation, and in some cases also a little bit of fluid and sodium restriction. How do we do that? So normally the management of these cases will be more directed to use appropriate drugs. In this case, will be vasodilators like ACE inhibitors, inotropes, like it could be pimobendan, which has an inotropic effect, and also a vasodilatory effect, antiarrhythmics, whenever there is a detectable arrhythmia that we can treat. And then remember that arrhythmias often make the heart work less effectively, and also diuretics such as furosemide. And finally, the use of oxygen is always indicated in these cases. It will never do any harm, and in many cases, is absolutely life-saving. So when we do fluid resuscitation in the normal cases of hemorrhagic or septic shock or the likes, how much fluid is enough? The main thing I have to say is that from experience again, I tend to see much more or many more under-resuscitated patients than over-resuscitated. And whenever fluid resuscitation was slightly excessive, it's not difficult to actually correct this excess fluid and eliminate it fairly easily. So my recommendation is to be aggressive, like I said at the beginning, and use larger boluses of fluids to achieve your cardiovascular endpoints. So how do we do this? If we are going to use crystalloids as our main fluid for resuscitation, then I would recommend to use boluses of 10 to 20 milliliters per kilo in a very short period of time, within 5 to 10 minutes, and then reassess or assess the effect of these boluses as they are delivered, and then repeat them as necessary to achieve our targets in terms of heart rate, blood pressure, quality of pulse, mentation, perfusion markers, and blood pressure. And then remember the differences between controlled versus uncontrolled hemorrhage in terms of your aims for resuscitation. So controlled hemorrhage is resuscitation in full. Uncontrolled hemorrhage, we just go for moderate improvements and suboptimal blood pressures. So what type of fluid are we going to use? Well, there are several options. The main option that everybody has available will be crystalloids, such as 0.9% saline or Hartmann's. We can also administer whole blood or packed red cells from the blood bank. There is also some colloids available, although fewer of them at the moment. We can also use hypertonic saline 7.2%. And in the past, we used to be able to use oxyglobin, which is a very useful drug in cases of shock, but at the moment is not available. So, what about crystalloids? In my opinion, the main advantages of crystalloids is that they are widely available. So, every single practice will have Hartmann's and saline 0.9%. They're relatively inexpensive. And research shows that in the majority of cases, they're really very efficacious. So you will see a positive effect by using it. What are, however, the disadvantages of using crystalloids for resuscitation in cases of shock? One of them is that there will be some extravasation of this fluid by using large amounts of them once the osmotic pressure and the hydrostatic pressure between the intravascular and the extravascular compartment are in equilibrium. A lot of that fluid will have gone from the vascular compartment into the extravascular one, so the peripheral tissues, will cause situations of edema. And the other one is hemodilution. These fluids are devoid in large molecules like proteins and the likes, and also, of course, they don't have red cells or platelets. Therefore, by giving large volumes of crystalloids, we will decrease the concentration of red blood cells, the concentration of platelets, and the concentration of proteins in plasma. So, when do we need blood and when should we give it? Everybody talks always about what is a transfusion trigger, and a lot of people use a certain number, a certain figure of or percentage of PCB or concentration of hemoglobin to decide to give a transfusion. However, very many research efforts have been unable to determine what is the exact transfusion trigger for a large population of patients, and it's one thing that we will have to decide individually based on our clinical judgment. So a patient with a dog with a PCB of 20% that has been like that for weeks and is normobulimic might be fairly stable and be able to withstand an anesthetic and many other procedures, while a normal dog that suffers from a very sudden and peri-acute hemorrhage and the PCB is still kind of normal or relatively low, but almost within normal, might actually have a very severe situation of hypovolemia and shock. So it will have to be guided based on the hemodynamic status of the patient and the laboratory findings and the clinical history. So, do I need, in case I decide to give a blood transfusion or packed red cell transfusion, do I need to blood type the patient? So the answer is yes, always, unless you're in a desperate life or death situation where there is no time and you do not have the means to blood type it, and you know that that patient has not had a blood transfusion before. In that case, it would be possible in dogs to give a blood transfusion, and then the patient will be sensitized in that first contact with a potentially incompatible blood, and that needs to be recorded. However, the recommendation always is to blood type dogs and cats, and definitely always, always, always in cats. So, what is a safe rate of infusion for a blood transfusion? Again, there is no such thing. In an emergency situation, it could be as fast as possible. And in cases where a patient is in need of a blood transfusion but relatively stable, it is recommended to start the blood transfusion at a very low rate for the first few minutes, first half an hour, so as low as maybe 0.5 or 1 mL per kilo per hour. And if there is no adverse reactions, then we will increase that and deliver this blood unit within the next 4 hours or so. But like I said, in a situation of greater urgency, you can give it as fast as required, like open up the drip and then give it as fast as possible. And what are the side effects of blood transfusion? Well, there are obviously the risk of anaphylactic reactions and mistakes by giving incompatible blood, contaminated blood, and also it is well known that by giving blood transfusions, there is an activation of the immune system of the patient in each case, which will have some potentially negative effects in the outcome of the case in the longer term. The other thing to remind everybody is that there is a limited availability of blood products, so we need to use them wisely. This is a very different situation to human beings, where blood banks are much more powerful, if you like, and then the availability of blood and blood products is much bigger. So, what about colloids? Colloids are also potentially very useful in the management of shock and resuscitation or volume fluid resuscitation. However, are they any better than Hartmann's or saline? And the answer is probably not in the majority of cases. And further on to this, I would say that there are some different types of cases of shock where crystalloids are probably superior to colloids. What does this mean? It means that if a crystalloid is as effective as a colloid in terms of outcomes, and it is also cheaper, well, do we actually have a real reason to use a colloid for resuscitation? So there are different types of shock and different approaches to each treatment. We should say that in the recent years there has been great concerns about the use of colloids and their potential effects in increased mortality and renal injury in human beings, which has been also reported in veterinary species. This concern is much greater when we are talking about patients with septic shock, for which it is totally contraindicated. However, in hemorrhagic shock, many clinicians still feel like there is a place for the use of colloids at a much more reduced volumes than crystalloids for volume replacement and resuscitation. So, where would we use a colloid? So, normally we would use colloids in case of severe hemorrhage, in a like a proportion of one volume of blood loss or one unit of blood loss, so one unit of colloid replaced. And for this, perhaps there would be some advantages in terms of the college not disrupting so much the glycocalyx of the vascular endothelium and not causing so much extravasation of fluid. However, we need to know that colloids are more expensive, and amongst their side effects, as like we said, there would be kidney damage. There is also the potential for affecting the coagulation and also anaphylactic reactions. What about hypertonic saline 77.2%? How does it work? Well, this is a very hypertonic, so a highly salted, let's say, fluid that has a draws fluid from the extravascular space into the intravascular space for a short period of time until the osmolality of both spaces is equilibrated. So when is it useful? Well, it might be very useful in cases where we want to provide a rapid resuscitation with a smaller volume, like in severe hemorrhage in larger patients, or in cases where we are concerned about the extravasation of fluid when there is, for instance, some respiratory involvement. And it's also useful in cases of head trauma or intracranial hypertension, where there are the advantages are even further in terms of protection of the brain. How do we use it? Hypertonic saline, unlike 0.95 saline or isotonic saline, needs to be used in very small amounts. So usually we provide a bolus of between 2 and 4 mL per kilo over a period of about 5 minutes and assess the situation. And that needs to be followed by an infusion of normal crystalloids at a kind of a standard rate, at least, or as indicated. It's important to remind everybody that hypertonic saline will only work for a short period of time, and something else will need to be done after. And also, it is not indicated to be used in cases of dehydration, because the patient is already has a state of hypertonicity, and hypertonic saline will be a lot less effective and cause some electrolyte derangement. What about vasopressors? Vasopressors will be useful once we have corrected any fluid losses, or in cases where fluid hypovolemia, in cases where hypovolemia is not a concern, so like cardiogenic shock or the likes. So when do we use them? In hemorrhagic shock, they will be rarely necessary. In septic shock or cardiogenic shock, maybe more often. And what they do is they restore the vascular resistance and regulate it to a desired level to maintain some blood pressure and perfusion. However, it is important to clarify that blood pressure and perfusion are related variables, but they're not actually the same. So there would be situations perhaps where there is severe vasoconstriction where our pressure will be adequate, but perfusion to the main organs might not be sufficient. And finally, I will have I have collected like three hypothetical cases of shock and the way I would approach them. So the first case example, it's Leo, which is a 2-year-old male neuter Staffy that presented to our hospital with a distended abdomen. As you can see in the picture, there is concerns about some subcutaneous hematomas and blood accumulation. So you know, we suspected that it could be a case of rodenticide toxicity and therefore a coagulopathy. So on presentation, the dog had a heart rate of 180, a respiratory rate of 110, with non-palpable peripheral pulses and pale mucous membranes. We took a little blood sample, and one of the most important findings is that it had a PCD of 27%, which in the first place, it doesn't look too bad, and total protein of 40 grams per liter. And it's important to say that this was a per-acute presentation. So how would I approach this case? So the first thing I want to do is to the dog is tachycardic and tachypneic, so I would like to provide some oxygen. And while I'm doing that, I have collected all this data, and I would include also a temperature. So we place a peripheral catheter, and from there we are going to do a coagulation test and a blood smear. Somebody in the meantime is collecting a clinical history from the owner of the patient, and we will shortly apply some level of monitoring, including probably SpO2, blood pressure, and ECG. So, if we thought it would be a case of coagulopathy with rodenticide, we would apply the treatment with vitamin K and the available drugs. And after that, we will make sure that we provide enough oxygen. And if we feel like the patient is hypovolemic, we will start resuscitation. Ideally, in this case, with either whole blood or with plasma, depending on the amount of red cells and platelets available. It's very important to remember that the PCB in periacute cases might not be representative of the true PCB of the patient, because the time it takes for the PCB or the adjustments of from the extravascular compartment and the intravascular compartment after blood loss might not be enough for the PCB to be stable. Therefore, in some cases, it has to be assumed that the real PCB after resuscitation might be lower than what we have in the initial presentation. In cases of coagulopathy, fresh frozen plasma or fresh plasma or whole blood will add the coagulation factors that are necessary to stop the hemorrhage. And another thing I forgot to say is that this dog would have an abdominal scan, a fast scan, to check for effusions. In this case, it's very likely also that there might be hemorrhage to the respiratory tree, and therefore the hypoxemia that needs to be addressed. Case example two is Monty. This is a 3-year-old Bengal cat that came to our surgery lethargic, semi-collapsed, and with bloody diarrhea. And in this case, on our basic physical exam and cardinal signs, we noticed that there was hypothermia. The temperature was just about 36 degrees Celsius, with a heart rate of 130 and respiratory rate 32, with weak femoral pulses and pale mucous membranes, and some mild abdominal discomfort. So again, this is a typical picture of a cat in shock, where the main features are hypothermia and a relatively normal heart rate, but which is inadequate for a cat in a stressful situation. What are we going to do? We will do an abdominal scan to see what's happening there. And what we found is that there was free abdominal fluid and some injuries. The cat was resuscitated with a bolus of crystalloids, and there was no blood donor available in this case, as I remember. And in theater, we actually thought it could be perhaps a spontaneous hemorrhage, but then we realized that there was a pellet that had been shot to the cat, and then the blood that we collected from the abdomen was not useful for auto transfusion, which is always a possibility if it's clean blood. But the cat actually did all right with crystalloid resuscitation and surgery. And finally, our third case is a 6-month-old Cocker Spaniel that has suffered a road traffic accident a couple of days ago, which or 3 days ago, which resulted in a ruptured bladder that was repaired immediately. And there was also some pelvic fractures. And then, because of this difficult situation of the cat and the emergency of the case, it was decided that the pelvic fracture would be a major surgery that could be delayed, and it was scheduled for 3 days later. The dog was much more stable at the time of the pelvic fracture repair. However, during the anesthetic, after 2 hours into the surgery, There was a sudden onset of tachycardia with low blood pressure, hypocapnia, and pale mucous membranes. So we suspected that due to the surgical manipulation, we had a situation of severe hemorrhage. So we did a fast scan in theater, which suggested the presence of some retroperitoneal hemorrhage. And I have to say, before that, we had checked with the surgeon, and the surgeon was unaware of any hemorrhage in the surgical site. So these retroperitoneal hemorrhage evolve into an abdominal hemorrhage due to the rupture of the communication or the opening of the communication between the retroperitoneal space and the peritoneum as a result of the previous trauma. And the dog went into hemorrhagic shock very severely, which required surgical intervention and also several blood transfusions and resuscitation. So this was in the first place a case of uncontrolled hemorrhage that we resuscitated to suboptimal values of mean blood pressures of around 50 to 60 millimeters of mercury, and then we were slowly giving whole blood and packed red cells as required until it could the source of hemorrhage could be repaired, and then a full resuscitation was instituted and was successful. So that would be maybe like a less usual scenario, but also something you're going to find on a regular basis. And this third case came to the end of the lecture, so I hope you enjoyed it. And if there are any questions, please let me know. I will leave you with my email address in case anybody wants to contact me for any further information or scientific papers to support some of the advice I have provided today. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Miguel for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.